point I'd like to make about the Inquisition is that it was not simply or even primarily a repressive institution, but also a formative institution. As I've said before, in the period between about 1540 and about 1700, the Inquisition was, in effect, primarily concerned with what it regarded as the vulgarities of popular culture and the problems of reforming them. It worried primarily about superstition, about blasphemy, about fornication, and about embarrassing rural offenses like bestiality. The Inquisition was also involved in censorship, and it issued an index of prohibited books. Now, again, there is no denying that this had some kind of a chilling effect on scholarship, but again, we need to qualify this in at least two respects. First of all, the Inquisition sought not so much to prevent people from reading, but rather to direct their reading and to direct their thinking. Indeed, the Inquisition was surprisingly tolerant of a lot of the new science emerging in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries. The astronomer Galileo, for example, never had his works put on the index of the Spanish Inquisition, and the works of the astronomer Kepler were actually allowed to circulate, provided that a note was inserted in the book that said something to the effect, "Warning, you are reading the works of a heretic." Second of all, the Inquisition's allegedly deleterious effects on culture and literature have really been grossly exaggerated. It used to be common in a lot of English-speaking texts to claim that the Inquisition, you know, turned Spain into a benighted place with no culture and no thought. But in the first place, the Index of Prohibited Books did not necessarily ban works outright. It often only required a certain expurgation that be made. For example, in Cervantes's Don Quixote, there is one line that had to be corrected because it's made something, comment about the virtue of charity, which the Inquisition didn't like. One way or another, however you want to slice it, the 16th and 17th centuries were clearly a golden age of Spanish art and literature. A sixth point I'd like to make about the Inquisition, and this is really worth stressing, is that it was above all a tool of the Spanish crown, that is to say, a tool of the state. The Inquisitor General and the members of the Supreme Council of the Inquisition were appointed by the crown. And there was no appeal from the judgments of the Inquisition, not even to the Pope. In fact, the papacy was very unhappy about this, and several times made efforts to restrain the activities of the Spanish Inquisition or to have cases transferred to Rome's jurisdiction for a decision. And yet, in 300 years of history, the Pope only managed to claim three cases of appeal from the clutches of the Spanish Inquisition. The Inquisition was, in other words, a very close and subordinate ally of the Spanish crown, and on more than one occasion, its power would be abused for political purposes. In fact, the character of the Inquisition as an arm of the crown is particularly obvious in the character of its personnel. Most inquisitors were not fanatical theologians and priests. They were lawyers, trained in civil law, not in canon law. The last point I'd like to make about Philip's monarchy, before we close, is the fact that it was an international empire which was huge, but one which also made enormous demands on Spain and forced it into enormous commitments. The size of the Spanish Empire is really truly striking. It included not only the Netherlands, but also the region of Franche-Comté, or modern Burgundy in eastern France. It included large parts of Italy, Latin America, also the Philippines, as well as outposts in North Africa, some of which Spain retains to this day. In 1580, the empire was further expanded when the Portuguese crown died out and Spain absorbed Portugal and its colonial empire, including Brazil, Angola, and ports on the coasts of India. And yet at the same time, the very size of the empire meant that Spain was constantly beset with threats from all quarters, from the Ottoman Turks in the western Mediterranean, from the French in Franche-Comté, the Netherlands, and in Italy. You'll recall the Habsburg-Valois struggle. The Spanish empire was often threatened by English and Dutch pirates in the Caribbean or in the Pacific. And all of these distractions regularly diverted Spanish resources and attention. They made it very impossible, or virtually impossible, for Philip to deploy his full strength in the Netherlands for any extended period of time. He always found himself wanting to send more troops or more money to the Netherlands, and yet being forced to pull back because he had to deal with the Turks or the French or the English and the Dutch. That then concludes our discussion of the Spanish monarchy. In our next lecture, we will look at the Netherlands itself on the eve of its revolt from Spain.